the title of this talk is Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Vance Persistent Threat. And this is joint work with Ari Jules. This is joint work with Ari Jules from RSA Labs. So in recent years, we've read in news about several successful cyber attacks against high-profile targets. For example, the attack dubbed Operation Shady Rat that stole sensitive information from governments, defense contractors, the United Nations, and the International Olympics Committee. Operation Aurora on Google in China in 2009 that stole source code and personal information about human rights activists. The attack on RSA in 2011 targeted specifically at our Secure-ID two-factor authentication tokens. And subsequent attacks on Lockheed Martin and other defense contractors, and political espionage on several countries in the former Soviet Union. So in industry terms, these attacks are called Advanced Persistent Threats, or APTs. These are sophisticated and highly targeted attacks to access or steal information from organizations and computing systems. So APTs are advanced in the sense that the attacker not only has access to all the available intrusion tools, but also have the abilities to research new vulnerabilities and develop custom exploits or intelligence gathering techniques. They're persistent in the sense that once inside, the attacker maintains a foothold in this victim organization, quietly monitoring what's going on in the network and trying to seek out his target information. And finally, they are a threat because they have both the capabilities and intent. These APT attackers are very well motivated, they are well organized and very well funded, often by nation states. So in the past, we've also seen malware that targets specific platforms, and that can also be very sophisticated. So what is different about these APT attacks? So in this table, I try to compare between APT attackers and traditional attackers, which broadly refers to the perpetrators behind general threats like viruses and worms and trojans and botnets. These two types of attackers are similar in the way they obtain entry into a system, such as through software vulnerabilities or through social engineering. However, APT attackers have very different objectives and motives. Rather than sending spam, perform DDoS, or identity theft, the goal is espionage and intellectual property theft in order to elevate the attacker's military, political, and technical status. An example would be stealing the design plans for a military fighter jet or the source code of a widely used software in order to exploit it. In addition, while general malware tries to spread to as many machines as possible, APT attackers craft attacks specifically for the victim organization. And they often try to compromise user credentials so that they can access other machines within the victim's internal network without triggering alerts. This low and slow behavior is a characteristic of APTs, where the attacker is concerned about being stealthy and maintaining a foothold in the victim organization. And so these attacks can take place over an extended amount of time. And also because the attacker may not know or only have limited knowledge about the internals of the victim organization beforehand, APTs rely on manual intervention to adjust and adapt to different types of scenarios. Somewhat contrary to what most people would expect, the victims of APTs are not limited to governments and big companies, but also include nonprofits, sports committees, news media, and the energy and electronic industry. And these are just the attacks that have been publicized. Probably many, many more others have gone undetected. As an example of how APTs work, usually the attacker sends spear phishing emails to a handful of employees in the target organization. If the employee opens attachments or clicks on links within the email, her computer becomes infected, allowing access to her user credentials that the attacker uses to gain access to other machines within the victim's organization. The attacker may compromise more hosts along the way or steal other users' credentials until he obtains access to a server hosting the targeted sensitive information. This information is then exported secretly to a site controlled by the attacker. This sequence of steps is commonly observed in documented APTs, with the four major steps being social engineering, command and control, lateral movement, and then data exfiltration. It has become somewhat common to recognize these series of events as sort of a formula for APTs. And in response, countermeasures have been crafted to detect spear phishing emails, to detect the exfiltration of encrypted and compressed data, and to detect traffic from Poison Ivy, a remote access tool that was used in several APTs. However, the main message that we want to convey in this paper, sorry.
Can I make a quick point? There was an intrusion on the medical center at University of Washington in 2001 that exactly fits that same description. And to some degree, the cuckoo's egg is a similar kind of thing. So when you're saying new, and I hate now the term APT because these really aren't that new. These techniques have been used for years and decades.
Right, I was just trying to compare it with like botnets and worms and viruses, which are more general. It's not targeted like this one. So the main message we want to convey here is that APT is not a vector of attacks or a playbook of tactics. It's a campaign. And the attackers are in no way bound by a formula or just limited to cyber threats. So as an exercise in flexible thinking and caution against narrow characterization of APTs, we explore other clever deceptions that may be used by future APTs if they're not being used already. And for this, we appeal to the stories of Sherlock Holmes by Arthur Conan Doyle. And in the following, I will describe a few of Sherlock Holmes' cases and how its major element of deception can be used as an attack strategy in the APT setting. The first story we consider is The Adventure of the Red-Headed League. So the story goes that a band of thieves wants to get a shop owner named Mr. Wilson away from his shop so they can tunnel into a bank vault next door. Now, since this tunneling may take some time, the thieves want Mr. Wilson to be away from his shop consistently at the same time, around the same time every day, without arousing suspicion. So to accomplish this, they posted an ad in the paper for a lucrative position, but open only to red-headed applicants. And hundreds of people apply. This video works here.
Suited.
And of course, Mr. Wilson lands the job. This crowd of red-headed applicants served as a cover for the existence of a single target applicant. So in what we call a red-headed league attack, the deception strategy is to encompass the victim in a general event that conceals a target attack. For example, let's consider the use of botnets in APTs. Since bots usually try to spread to as many hosts as possible to send spam or perform DDoS attacks, they are often overlooked or just given lower priority by admins who are only interested in detecting APTs. But an attacker can launch a red-headed APT by renting a botnet that's large enough to include machines from the targeted organization. This allows the attacker a foothold into that organization while bypassing the standard social engineering step and concealing the victim in a general common event, that is bot infections. Even worse, the attacker can launch spear phishing emails in parallel so that to further divert attention from the actual attack. We can do a back of the envelope calculation here. So there are roughly 1 billion PCs in use worldwide today. There are about 400,000 IBM employees. And let's just assume that every IBM employee has at least one PC. If bot infections were uniform, which no, it may not be, then an attacker just has to rent a botnet that includes at least 2,500 bots, and that would likely include a machine owned by one of the IBM employees. But similar to how spear phishing exploits trust relationships, a patient attacker can slowly and anonymously build more durable and general trust relationships. For example, by contributing to an open source software community so that custom crafted software would be used and even incorporated into products. Leveraging the friend finding feature in social networks so that users would be tricked into contacting others who share similar interests in geographical locations. A study performed by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security showed that 60% of the government employees would pick up USB sticks or CDs lying in their parking lot and plug them into their office computer. Of course, another way would be to hold an industry workshop just to pass out infected USB sticks. In The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, a member of the staff at a hotel steals a rare blue gem from the Countess of Morcar, who was staying at the hotel. Afraid of being caught with the gem and at a loss of what to do, the thief runs to his sister's house, who happens to be a goose breeder.
When suddenly, I looked at the geese, which was hissing and huddling in the corner of the yard. My sister had told me that I might have the pick of her geese for a Christmas present. I picked out one of the birds, a fine big one with a grey head. I pushed the stone down its throat as far as my finger could reach.
Sorry for the bad quality of the video. But the point was, by planting this gem inside the goose, both the thief and the gem got away. But just unfortunately for the thief, he later lost the goose when it was sold to the market and ended up with one of Sherlock Holmes' clients. So in what we call blue carbuncle attack, deception strategy is to conceal unauthorized communications within commonplace objects or activities. In documented APTs, this high-value ACID is usually encrypted, compressed, and then exfiltrated over common protocols like HTTP and FTP. But there's no reason why this exfiltration cannot take place over other popular services like Skype or via steganographic techniques to embed it in images or PDFs. A patient attacker can extract pieces of the file slowly over time, leveraging unused fields in IPTCP headers, or just otherwise piggybacking up on existing communications. Rather than exporting this data from within the victim organization, the attacker can first transfer this data onto an employee's laptop and then export it later when the laptop is brought to the employee's home or to a local coffee shop. The organization's network policies can be bypassed completely using external Wi-Fi hotspots near the facility where this compromised host is sitting. In a scandal in Bohemia, Sherlock Holmes is tasked with retrieving a photograph of his client, the King of Bohemia, and his former mistress, Miss Adler. The King wants this photograph to avoid a scandal in his upcoming marriage, though Miss Adler would not surrender this photo and has hidden it so well that all of the King's previous search efforts were fruitless. Well, Sherlock Holmes takes a different approach to recovering this photo.
Madam? Madam, I think I can smell fire.
What?
Fire! Fire!
So by simulating a fire in Miss Adler's house, Sherlock Holmes causes her to rush to save the photograph and hence revealing its secret location. So in what we call a Bohemian scandal attack, the deception strategy is to create disturbances or simulate threats to the victim in order to obtain intelligence about a target resource. Recommended responses to an APT often aim to prevent collateral damage and to preserve forensic evidence. For example, it is recommended to deploy additional monitoring at critical servers, to quarantine suspect infected hosts, and to change compromised user credentials, and also to configure alternative infrastructure for necessary services. However, many of these actions actually give useful information to the attacker. For example, the deployment of additional monitoring reveals the locations of the important servers. The configuring of alternative infrastructure reveals the necessary services required by the organization's operation. And the quarantine or shutdown of compromised hosts and user accounts reveals the extent of the victim's knowledge about the attack. Rather than probing around for this type of information, the attacker can deliberately leave traces of his presence and then just observe subsequent actions from the victim. In The Adventure of the Speckle Band, a murder is committed inside in a room locked from the inside without any signs of violence. There were no suspects since it was impossible for a human to have entered and left the room except for the victim. Mr. Sherlock Holmes investigates this case. It turned out that no human had entered the room, but the crime was committed by a trained poisonous snake that traveled through the ventilator and down the bell rope onto the bed where the victim was lying. And so in what we call a speckled band attack, the deception strategy is to breach a security perimeter through unconventional means. Companies usually try to prevent against entry by unauthorized people by posting no tailgating signs like this. But instead of people, a robot can be used to enter an organization through the ventilation system, through an open window, or by a package in the mailroom. Such robots can gather intelligence about the organization's internals, steal data directly from the host, or just tamper within physical infrastructure. And programmable robots with various sensing capabilities like sight, touch, and sound are already available for only a few hundred dollars. But of course, malware can be introduced surreptitiously in other settings as well, such as digital photo frames that come with pre-installed viruses, infected mobile phones that spread to nearby devices through vulnerabilities in Bluetooth, or the malware can even be embedded in device drivers during manufacturing. And of course, the appearance of an unbreachable space may be an illusion created by the attacker, who removed his ventilators and bell ropes after the fact, for example, by patching the vulnerability that he exploited, or deleting the system logs that give evidence to the intrusion. So in summary, the key message we want to convey here is that APT is a campaign, and so it does not follow any formula or playbook. We should not be limited by the few narrow cases of documented APTs, but think broadly about other ways of carrying out a targeted attack. An important follow-up question here is, how do we detect APTs? Well, we don't have a good solution to this yet, but there are a couple of directions that look promising. For example, we can profile the network behaviors of users and hosts. During an APT, we may not observe a failed login attempt or a snort signature being fired, but we may see that a user is trying to access a machine that he has never contacted before, even though he may have the privileges to do so. And of course, the use of clever deceptions is not a right of the attackers alone, but some form of defensive deception may also be useful to us to some degree, such as honeypots, planted vulnerabilities, or intentionally leaked documents. And lastly, sharing information about a breach with others who face the same or similar threats would be invaluable in preventing or stopping an attack before full damage is done. But there are some other issues with this, such as trusting those others with which you share the information, and the danger of this information leaking out and tipping off the attackers on what we know about the attack. So there are still a lot to be done in this area. That concludes my talk. Thanks for your attention. I'll be happy to take any questions.
So I have one question. So how do you see the role of education to stop APT? Because it looks like many of the attacks actually work because people get social engineered, right? So is that one thing that, you know?
Well, I think if you have the time and the patience, you can get anybody to open an email. Like, you can send an email to, you can get anybody to open an email, right? If you make it really specific. So I don't know. I think it's a good approach to for most people, but for a really targeted attacker, it may not be a good solution.
Hi, Manuel Egele from UCSB. So at one of your almost first slides when you were comparing the legacy threats against the APTs, you only had financial incentives on the legacy threats. So I would assume an attack on a bank, for example, banking institution, could be seen as an APT and would also fall into the financial category. But that's not what I'm after. The question what I'm after is, are banks just doing a way better job than everybody else involved, or are they just way less open about, so that we never heard of any APTs succeeding in their realms?
So because the...
Yes, they're better than everybody else, so we go to class at the banks now.
I think there are a lot of APTs that just go on undetected, so it's really hard to know who's infected or not.
Hi, my name is Jason Britt. I'm from UAB. When you were talking about the, the League of Redheaded People?
Yeah.
Basically a needle in a haystack type thing. You had said that APTs might run out of botnet. With the increased kind of visibility that you'd have at RSA, have you seen maybe an instance where somebody's been motivating an attack or claiming a social kind of hacktivist attack when actually it's an APT type attack buried underneath that? Have you seen any instances of that, I guess?
I have not, but of course at the same time, I don't have all the intelligence about what's going on at the RSA security incident response team, so it's possible.
To piggyback on that question a little bit, so can you go to your last slide? And given that RSA is a company who has, publicly has experienced these APTs, what can you say publicly about what RSA does with respect to your last three bullets and the value associated with these?
So since I joined RSA, I've been trying to start a research program on log analysis and data analysis for security applications. I would say we've done most in the behavioral profiling aspect, because we have these system logs from the entire enterprise. It includes, Windows logs, DHCP, firewalls, routers, proxies, everything that's going on, but they're just not doing anything with it. I think if we do analyze those logs, we would see unusual activities, like what I mentioned. In APT, the attacker is trying not to generate any logs. So he's going to... I have access to all these machines. I'm going to try every machine that I have access to, but those may not be the machines that I usually access. So we see these different type of patterns that we're trying to detect here.
So with your research hat on, can you tell us some of the challenges that you face at RSA and how the community can help you with any of those bullets that you're working on right now?
So the first thing is that these logs are very messy and inconsistent. So there are missing fields, and the timestamp doesn't have a time zone, and it's just a mess. So I don't know if that's a research question, but other aspect of it is just there's so many false alarms, and their normal traffic itself is unusual, right? So trying to come up with a good characteristic for the host and how do you compare between hosts has been one of the major problems.
So to piggyback on that question, do you think that the logs that you have collected would have been sufficient to detect attacks in the past? Or do you think you actually have to revisit how you do the log collection too in order to be able to detect these kind of attacks in the future?
I think the logs itself are not sufficient because it collects everything going through it. There are a lot of things we still don't see. For example, we see firewall logs, but if something's going on within the same subnet, then we don't see anything at all. And we don't see anything on the end host itself. It's just when I authenticate myself to a domain controller, then I see a log.
And are there any particular logs you think that you're not getting at the moment that would be particularly valuable to help with this?
Stuff going on machine, like the Windows security logs, would be quite helpful, I think, that we're not getting.
Tudor Dimitris from Symantec Research. So it seems that many of the recent targeted attacks that have been publicly disclosed have had a zero-day attack in the beginning to gain access to the network perimeter, but remain stealthy. So I was a bit surprised that you didn't mention this in your talk. So what are your thoughts? Working exploits for unknown, undisclosed vulnerabilities and necessary ingredients for APTs or not?
So are you asking about 0 days?
Yeah.
I think that they fall in the category of software vulnerabilities, right? They're used a lot in APTs, but I don't know if there's a good way to detect 0 day yet. That's something we're trying to do.
Right, but it seems to me that you proposed a whole set of alternative ways that attackers could gain access to the network perimeter. So is this something that you see happening in the future, or?
I think it's already happening now. Talk offline.
All right, well, let's thank ThinkFang one more time.